Hey, welcome to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative professionals and entrepreneurs looking to grow by learning new things, getting inspired, and breaking down the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to episode 97, Interview with Keith Lay. Keith is a designer, educator, and business consultant in Portland, Oregon. And in this episode, we talk about how creativity and technology has changed throughout his career, the importance of understanding business principles, why differentiation is critical, and what the Portland area is going to be known for in the future. Show notes for this episode are available at gwtw.co/97. Are you passionate and motivated to make the world a better place and wonder how you're going to market your work? Chris Martin Studios is a video production company telling stories with heart, edge, and fearlessness for those who dare to build a better world. Head to chrismartinstudios.com to see the latest goods produced for people just like yourself. And while you're there, sign up for my weekly email newsletter, The Curiosity Lab. It's a great way to stay connected with Chris Martin Studios and meet awesome people changing the world. All right, you ready for this interview with Keith? Take it away, Adobe Audition. Keith, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. Why don't you start by introducing yourself and share a little bit about what you do?
My name is Keith Lay. I am relatively new to Portland. In fact, this week is the one-year anniversary of my coming to Portland.
Oh, fantastic.
I can call myself a local now, can I?
I think so, yeah.
Is that correct? I actually come from Vancouver, Canada. I actually ran an agency in web and software development there for many years. And I sold that, and now I'm just basically trying to figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up.
So you mentioned that you had your own agency, and you do some other things now, consulting and being an educator. How has your approach to the creative life changed over the years throughout those different roles?
Well, you know, I come from a print design background, if you go back far enough through the sands of time. And at that time, which was with the early days of what we used to call desktop publishing, it was all, you know, what kind of came from that was that as one person, you could do absolutely every aspect of the production process. The bad part of it is you had to do every aspect of the production process. So, I come from a background where I did a lot of, kind of the solopreneur heavy lifting, figuring out how to design things, figuring out how to technically make things work. And I took that sort of skill set through the early days of multimedia and CD-ROM and the early days of the web and the early days of mobile. I think my mother always said I was always on the leading edge of profitability.
What a great thing for a mom to say to you.
Yeah, just always one step ahead of making any money. As I evolved, I moved from doing the design and production to managing people that did design and production and taking more of a client-facing role. But I always felt that coming from that background was very helpful for me to kind of have that role as a translator between what the client was saying and what they wanted or what they weren't saying, what they didn't know they wanted, and what a studio could and could not accomplish, and kind of always being the nexus between those two worlds.
Was it a difficult transition to make from going from doing the work to managing other people doing the work?
Initially, I always have, I sort of have this memory of sort of in that mid-transition point, where I would spend a lot of time on Excel or Word, either putting out budgets or putting out proposals, and you sort of spend a day in Excel spreadsheets, and you sort of stop and think to yourself, didn't I used to design? I'm certain I used to design. But, what I really found that I did have a skill in talking to people and understanding people and hopefully being understood. And that was probably much better at that than I ever was at actually coming up with a design for something.
Oh, interesting. How long did it take you to learn that that was what you were best at?
Well, you know what was interesting, because I also, you know, for the last couple of decades, I've also done teaching as a part-time basis, but it's always been a part of my career. Mm-hmm. And I really fell into it, like just absolutely. I went to a technical college kind of on a tour because someone I knew introduced me to the director of the college. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the tour, the director said, "So do you think you'd be interested in teaching?" And I said, "Sure, that would, I'd certainly consider that." And he said, "Well, can you start Monday?" and I literally just out of the blue was all of a sudden teaching. But what I learned from that was that I actually had some skill in communicating concepts and being able to take something that was esoteric or technical or previously unknown to people and be able to present it in a way that made sense. And all of a sudden it's like, I can talk for a living. This is actually way easier than thinking.
Yeah. If once you can make that connection to speaking, and it really opens up the world to what you're able to do, I think.
And I always suspect that I was actually like a closet performer, like a frustrated, in another life, I would be a stand-up comedian or a stage performer or something like that, which, you know, it's a good thing this is a podcast because, you know, I've often been told I've got a face for radio. Oh. But so not really something that I would ever do. But certainly, you know, when you're in that classroom or if, you know, the times that I'm giving, doing a public speaking event, and you know, you tell a joke and the audience responds and laughs or lightens the mood of the room, and you just kind of like, oh yeah, just feel that wash over you. Give me more of that.
Yeah.
That's the drug right there.
Especially in a classroom where if you say something, I always found that it was when I'm trying not to be funny that I'm funny.
Right.
And then it's the pity laugh that I never liked.
Yeah, for sure. I was, I actually remember this. I was teaching an introductory class to HTML, when I was teaching at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, I basically did sort of the, if you've taken an arts degree, they always had that math for artists class, which was kind of the dumbed down math. And I did HTML for communication students, which was kind of along the same lines. Mm-hmm. So very introductory and always a really interesting and great group of people. But we were doing some inline styles. And one student was having trouble and she said, "Oh, I can't seem to get rid of my padding." And I just instinctively, I said, "Nah, tell me about it, sister." And it got, it was just an offhand remark, and it got a laugh out of the room. Like, oh, yeah, okay, that's where my skill is.
I love a good CSS joke, so kudos to you for that one. So one of the things that I appreciate about you is that you want to help creative professionals better understand business and business processes. So I thought I would have you talk about the things that we get wrong. What do we get wrong?
Well, Portland is one of the things that kind of blows me away about Portland. I've been coming down here kind of as a tourist probably for about 10 years and always really loving the city and loving kind of and Portlandia was kind of more like a guide for living than an actual, comedy show for me. But the creative community here is amazing. The amount of young talent that is in this town is just absolutely mind-blowing for what is basically a small market city in the U.S. Mm-hmm. It's a Minneapolis-sized city with a San Francisco level of talent in it. Mm-hmm. And it's incredibly young talent that it's almost innate, right? Like there's so many people here that just know how to do things and make things that are amazing. But at no point was there the business aspect to it. And when you are young and energetic and you have a great idea and you want to really kind of lift that idea, you're willing to jump into the deep end of the pool. You're willing to push the rock up the hill. And you do these things not because, you know, they're the right thing to do, but just because you want to and you have the energy. But that is not necessarily sustainable. And that's kind of the message that I talk about when I'm meeting and consulting with or mentoring with some of the young creatives that I've been meeting with here in Portland, is this idea of sustainability and scalability. Mm. That the pure, raw, naive energy that you were putting into making something work is not sustainable or scalable. And that, unfortunately, you're going to have to resort at some point to actual boring business practices. And I actually was really inspired. I went to a talk here in Portland. There was a panel of business people, and there was one fellow who had made a quote that I kind of remember. And he says, you know, in a business, 10% of what you do is your creative idea, and 90% is really boring, normal things that have never changed since forever. If you're not willing to learn or execute on that boring 90% of business stuff, you either need to hire someone or partner with someone who is. Hmm. And that will allow you to coddle and protect and grow that 10% of the business, which is your brilliant idea or your brilliant concept. And don't get creative with the other stuff. You know, I always thought this was a great idea. It's like, you know, creatives tend to want to find a creative solution to everything, and it turns out the IRS is really uninterested in a creative take on your taxes. They really aren't just interested in the novel way that you went about that. So
no, they aren't.
And it turns out that there are people all over the place that are really passionate and enthusiastic about doing your taxes and creating your term sheets and building your business plan and creating your marketing plan and running your administration and building your teams. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you need to find those people, and you need to, again, either hire or partner with those people. And, you know, a saying that I've been using when I've been meeting with people is, someone in your business needs to be in the business of business. Mm. And if that's not you, don't beat yourself up. Mm-hmm. Just find someone who's, you know, passionate about that.
Yeah. That's a really good point too, of not beating yourself up. Cause I think that sometimes the messages that we receive is that if you're not passionate about business, you shouldn't be in business. Whereas what I'm hearing you saying is, you can be in business, just find someone else if it's not you. And that's a great message.
Yeah. And again, you can partner with someone, you can hire someone. I mean, you know, I went through this myself, whereas, you know, there's aspects of business in terms of understanding it and, you know, strategizing around it that I've actually, you know, managed to either innately or through a great deal of trial and error get some skill at. But there's still aspects, you know, accounting is something that I have just no ability to do or interest in doing it. Mm-hmm. And you know, for a long time, I really was very hard on myself, you know, beat myself up about, why aren't I good at this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like, why am I not doing these things in a timely way? It's like, well, it's because you suck at it. And that's okay. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned accounting, you've mentioned marketing. What are some of the other things about business that creative professionals need to be doing that they don't think about?
Well, it's the good old-fashioned business plan. You know, the business plan is something that is always sort of an afterthought, and I think it's thought about in the wrong way. Mm. You know, a lot of people say, well, we have to have a business plan if we're going to go to the bank. Mm-hmm. Or if we're going to go to investors, mm-hmm. or if we're going to have, you know, some sort of investment in our organization, then we need to have a business plan, and it only exists for the sole purpose of showing to a bank or showing to investors. And right away, that's just an immediate recipe for failure, because, of course, you're not really invested in creating that as an actual plan for your business, and it tends to sort of then become a cynical exercise. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you know, a lot of people who are in the money giving business reject, you know, large swaths of business plans because they see immediately that it's not a real reflection of the business. And so I say, let's turn that around. Let's actually make this not a business plan, but a plan for your business in terms of, you know, a document that represents an actual step-by-step plan that you're going to look at this and say, this is what we're working on today. This is what we're working on this week. And move out of that sort of feast and famine mindset that that besieges a lot of young startups and creative agencies, where the only thing they're dealing with is the thing that's immediately on fire and in front of them. And when they're put that fire out, it's like, oh, okay, now what? Oh, well, I guess we have to get a client now because we just we're spending all the time putting out a fire, and now we don't have another client. And so instead of that, it's like, let's actually work a plan where you actually have a series of realistic steps that will actually take you through. And instead of saying, what's the panic thing that we need to do today because we didn't do it last week, it's more, no, let's look to the plan and let's execute it and bring a little bit of calmness and sanity to the chaos.
What are some of the things that go into a plan? You mentioned, you know, putting a plan into play and being able to get out of that panic mode. What are some of those things? Is it, you know, the number of networking events that you're going to go to, sales processes, you know, kind of shine a light on that for me?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, you know, all one has to do is a 30-second Google search and you'll get a lot of opinions and frameworks and, you know, even online fill in the blank question and answer sessions. And some of them are great tools. And so, you know, I'm always less concerned about the structure of a business plan, but more in terms of what it represents as a philosophy. And I kind of have a little 20 questions game that I play with organizations that I'm sitting down with, whether it's just to, you know, have a coffee and talk about their business or in a larger scope to kind of help them out with their business. And it's just basically 20 questions of where are you at? How are you, how did you get here? Where do you want to be? How do you plan to get there? And it's a really kind of eye-opening experience. It's sort of shining the bright light in the dark corners. You know, there's some things you need to have, especially if you are going for money. You know, you have to have some financials in place. You know, you have to have that classic SWOT analysis. You have to have some of those things in place. But for the most part, you know, a business plan, especially when you're starting out, it can literally be just as simple as here, it's a timeline. Like it's just a, you know, a kind of a grander to-do list. Here's a series of tasks that we want to accomplish, and here is a hopefully realistic timeline around it. And start with that. And then, you know, answer some hard questions about, you know, what is it actually going to cost to be in business? You know, I sat down with one young creative agency here in town, and I asked them, you know, what are your monthly costs? And they said $250. Wow. And I was like, what does that represent? And they said, well, this is how much it costs for our hot desk at the co-working space. I said, all right, well, let's think a little bit more ambitiously, right? Like, what does it actually cost? You know, so does that, what does that mean? It's like, you're not getting paid. You're not, you know, you're paying for your cell phone and your internet and upgrading your computer equipment out of your own pocket. So, you know, it's again, it's sort of shining a light into the dark corners and saying, let's look at this realistically and what, you know, you need to pay yourself. You need to, you know, be prepared for growth. You need to have contingency in place for when you do get that big client. And so it's more of a philosophical exercise to actually have an actual plan in place. And you know, there's a million templates that you can then apply it to.
Well, and what's interesting about it, Keith, is that, you know, you're talking about growth, and if you're in feast and famine mode, growth is not really something that you have the luxury of thinking about. And so I love this idea of the plan, because then growth becomes something that you can plan for.
one of the things that kind of started to really impress me about Portland and kind of why I eventually came here is I started to come down for the Design Week Portland events. I came to the one in 2014, and then I think there was the one in 2016 or something. I've been to, to a few of them. And you saw all of these agencies, and it was amazing to see just how many agencies were doing work here in Portland. And every last one of them had Nike on their client list. And I actually came to believe it's like, you know what, maybe Nike isn't actually a company. It's actually a social welfare organization whose sole purpose is to just make sure every young creative agency gets a small contract and can put it on their resume. But, you know, it got to the point, it's like, show me the agency who doesn't have Nike, and maybe I'll be impressed. But what happens here, and it's a little bit unique to Portland, is you come along and you're, you know, a couple of people, and you've got some creative ideas, and you make a pitch, and boom, you've got a Nike, or you've got an Adidas, or you've got a big client, and you're immediately, you know, launched into the stratosphere, and you're billing, you know, six figures, and you're ramping up, and you're staffing up, and you're buying foosball tables and muffins in the break room and stuff like that. And there was absolutely zero plan for the growth or the managing of the growth. Mm-hmm. And you see the opposite happen just as quickly, where that big contract goes away or some other thing happens, and then they're just, you know, they're adrift. Mm. So the plan needs to be in place so you know when the big pitch comes, you know, where you're going to be and how you're going to get there and how you're going to scale it and how you're going to sustain it. And that's everything from, the actual business side, the client side. But there's other pieces to it too. And this is kind of, you know, where you need to start to bring in some more experts. There's the whole team building and team management side of it, which is huge. Mm-hmm. You know, it's great when it's you and your buddies, and everyone gets along and everyone's kind of on the same, you know, track. But then as you start to grow and you need to actually, you know, have a cohesive team. Mm-hmm. And then there's the whole operations side, which is huge. You know, when we talked a little bit about the, you know, the accounting part and the taxes part, but then, you know, there's just the whole aspect of keeping the office running and making sure the payroll gets out on time and, you know, making sure that you're onboarding your employees in a good way, or mm-hmm. or downsizing, whatever they call it these days. You know, the operation side of it is huge. And again, if that's not your passion, you absolutely need to be aligning yourself with someone who's really good at that.
Yeah. You gave a workshop with Scopic recently, and you talk about the crowded market and the dilemma an entrepreneur faces. I'm going to quote something that I read in there, and it said, "To become recognized as an expert at the expense of casting a wide net and potentially lose business." So what do experts do that amateurs do not?
Well, it's the great entrepreneurial dilemma to start with. You know, as an entrepreneur, you feel like you just need whatever you can get in the door, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like whatever business you can get in the door. And, you know, when you're starting out, you kind of almost have to be that way. But, I think about, you know, again, I go back to, you know, checking out some of the design weeks, and you run into a lot of, young creatives that are maybe just out of school or, you know, just out of design school or what have you. And, I can't tell you how many times where they hand me a business card, and on the back of the business card, it says, "I'll do your logo and your letterhead and your business card and your website and your PowerPoint presentation." And my first thought is, you can't possibly be good at all of those things. And it would be so much more interesting to meet someone who's like, you know, I am really passionate about creating presentation slide decks for startup companies, and I've really put a lot of thought into this, and I've really kind of worked and mentored and studied, and I really know what those things need to say and how they have to look. And it's like, okay, you know, that's when that opportunity comes up, when I need that service, you're going to be the person that I'm going to call, mm-hmm. because I'm going to have confidence that you're going to be the expert in that. Now, the tricky part is that means is that if someone does need a logo designed or a video edited, they're not going to call you. Mm-hmm. And you're going to lose out on that business. But in the medium term, you're going to be positioned so much better. And just, you know, to take a personal anecdote to this, you know, when I started to get involved in the web, mm-hmm. even in the early days, even in the late 90s, 98, 99, it was already this ridiculously crowded marketplace where everyone and their dog had a shingle out saying they would do a website for you. And you would go into clients and they'd say, oh, yeah, we need to have like this, you know, website built. And we'd be like, all right, well, that'll be, you know, I don't know, $5,000. And they say, oh, well, you know, my cousin's got a kid who says he'll do it for $500. And then all of a sudden you were just, you know, sort of racing to the bottom. Mm-hmm. And so what I decided at that point in time is I needed two things. I needed a differentiator and I needed to just completely change the conversation. And so one of the things that I did is I actually hired on some programmers and we developed some content management systems, which now, of course, are dime a dozen or actually free for dozen. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was actually a relatively new idea. And we also just worked exclusively with other larger agencies to white label our services into those agencies. Mm-hmm. And what that did was it just completely removed me and my company from that ridiculous conversation of undercutting each other to zero.
Yeah.
So now we were just saying, well, you know, what your cousin's kid can't do this. We're just in a different place. We're offering a different service that has a higher barrier to entry.
Yeah.
We're presenting this to a client base that is not even having this conversation about someone living in their mother's basement. So that, you know, that's kind of my own personal anecdote, which is if it was a crowded marketplace in 1998, it's certainly going to be a crowded marketplace in 2018 coming up. Mm-hmm. So what can you do to remove yourself from that conversation where you're just getting beaten up because nobody thinks that what you're doing is anything different or special?
Yeah. So how can creative people think about differentiation and almost a niche when they're at times, I would imagine, afraid of missing those what if jobs, you know? How do we think about differentiation?
Well, the funny thing is of course you're going to do that other stuff. Of course you are, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to have a client, you know, let's say that you are in the business, and again, I'm just kind of pulling this example out of thin air, but you are in the business of doing pitch deck presentations, and you're just like become the expert in mm-hmm. doing pitch deck presentations. When you've got that client and they're really happy with your work, they're going to come to you and say, oh, by the way, can you do this? Can you do this? Can you do this? And you're really, yes, of course we can. And you'll just do that stuff anyways. So it's not like you're not going to do this other work, mm-hmm. but it's how you present yourself and it's how you put, where you're going to channel and funnel your passion and where you're going to show what you can actually do to solve problems, because that's actually the business that everyone is actually in. And you know, I kind of always ask this question, especially of creatives or young creative agencies, what business are you in? And they say, oh, well, we are a branding, we create branding, or we create video, or we, you know, we create special effects for film and television. And the reality is no, you're actually not in that business. You're in the client problem solving business. Hmm. And clients have some problem that's causing them anxiety, it's keeping them up at night, it's making their lives unhappy, and you're the one who's going to come along and say, you know what, we can reliably and repeatedly solve this problem for you. Hmm. And that's what they're going to give you money for. They're going to give you money because they believe and trust that you're going to solve their problem. Hmm. And do it in a way that the anxiety and their stress goes away.
So is learning about what that problem is as simple as, what do you lose sleep over? Or is there a more tactful way to ask about the problems that you're trying to solve?
Well, the interesting thing is, if you actually, you know, talk to creative people and even people on the tech side, you know, the startup, the software development side of, you know, startup businesses, they're doing all this work anyways. They're just not getting paid for it, is the problem. You know, if you talk to a branding designer, you'll find that they're spending a huge amount of time researching and going through the company and holding focus groups and asking questions and all of this effort that happens before, you know, they even open up a piece of software on the computer. But they're, you know, in many cases, they may be making the mistake of not realizing that that's where the value is and that's what they should be charging for, because the reality in this day and age is that making money off of production is very hard to do. Mm-hmm. Making money off of media buys is almost impossible. Making money off of reselling print or hosting is pennies now. So what are you going to make your money off of? Well, it's process. So for some people, you know, that's why we're hearing so much about UX now. Because UX is something that's a little bit more esoteric and it's a little bit more kind of specialized, and it's process and it's strategy. But maybe it is also in figuring out what the actual, you know, does the client, you know, the client comes to you and says, I need a brochure or I need a video or I need some communications piece, I need an email newsletter or what have you. Mm-hmm. Is that what they really need, or do they actually need you to figure out how to solve a storytelling problem for them, or they need you to figure out how to solve a communications issue or a sales logjam that they're having? That in fact, the value that you can bring to the client is to help them solve that problem, of which the video or the email newsletter is just a symptom or a product.
That's really fascinating. I love the conversation around value, because that's really where the conversation needs to be. And I think a lot of young creative professionals and, you know, more advanced creative professionals can still struggle with that idea of value and having a good understanding of what the value actually is. So just the way you've described it, of saying, you know, it's about solving problems, it's about, you know, making money on process, I think those are really good points.
Well, you know, it's eventually it does have to come down to a business case when you are selling something to a client. For very short periods of time, you can kind of get away with the cool factor. And I've, you know, certainly lived through this enough times. And we're seeing it again right now with virtual and augmented reality, in which there's some agencies here in town that are doing some amazing work in that. You know, it's kind of really mind-blowing stuff. And again, just the creativity is just kind of absolutely inspiring and awesome. But it's also, it's being sold because it's the cool thing today. Mm-hmm. You know, there's definitely some brands out there that they want to align themselves with whatever is hot and cool and youthful. And that's fine. You can all, with a new technology, we saw it in multimedia and we saw it in the early days of the web and we saw it in the early days of mobile, and we're seeing it again in virtual and augmented reality. You can definitely sell something because it's cool to a certain clientele for a very brief window of time. But it's all, at the end of the day, it's always going to revert to the same thing that it always does, is that you need to have a business case for why someone's going to give you money. And that you are going to do something for that client that will allow them to accomplish their goals. Do something faster, better, cheaper, more effectively than they were able to do before. And that is the problem that they have and that you're going to provide the solution to, and then that's what they're actually going to value and be happy to give you money in exchange for that.
That's fantastic. So I want to bring the conversation to your teaching experience, not necessarily about teaching, but the advice that you would give to students who are coming into a program that want to learn how to be a web designer or how to be a graphic designer. What do you tell them to actually take from their education in order to be different than everyone else coming out of design school?
Well, the funny thing is, I always saw it as not learning. I mean, my God, if you're paying someone to learn Photoshop, that you really shouldn't do that.
Exactly.
There's lots of really great books and online courses and free YouTube videos and that sort of thing. So there's two things that you're going to get out of a school experience that you cannot get from any other experience. And one is the cohort experience, that being with a group of people and making your first network there. Mm-hmm. And making your first contact so that you will work with in the future and that you will learn from each other. Every time I've had a cohort of students, you have some people that have strengths in one area and other people have strengths in the other, and they're learning as much, if not more, from each other just in that environment, from the class and the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And the other piece is learning how to learn. You know, I might teach you some introductory HTML, and in the past it's kind of hilarious to me, the software that I have taught in the past that not only doesn't even exist anymore, but that people would kind of strain to remember existing. Even something like Director, which used to be, pretty huge piece of software.
Yeah.
You get a certain generation that sort of looks at you quizzically when you mention it, like kind of making a Gilligan's Island reference or something. Like, they have no idea what you're talking about. So, the fact that I've taught people Macromedia Director a million years ago, they're clearly none of those people are using those software skills anymore. Mm-hmm. But what I hope is that those people are actually using the logical thinking skills and the problem-solving skills and the critical thinking skills in whatever technology that they are using today. Mm. And that learning how to learn is the most important part. I think that in North America, our public school education system has always been such a disservice to students in trying to teach people, teaching kids how to learn by rote and regurgitate on a test. Mm-hmm. It's just an absolute terrible way to learn anything of value. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, especially with younger students that I've had, if they are sort of more directly out of school, and I always made this analogy, instead of a programming concept, if I was teaching basic math and pretend that I would write 2 + 2 = 4 on the board, and all the students would sort of, dutifully write that down in their notebooks. And then the next day I would say, what is 2 + 2 =? And they would look at their notebook and say 4. And then I would say, well, what is, 2 + 3 =? And then they would look at their notebook and say, oh, you haven't taught us that yet. Hmm. We don't know the answer to that. And that's not the point. The point is what I'm trying to teach you is how to analyze that problem and how to come up with a solution to that problem so that later, when you're in a completely different software package or you're in a completely different industry or in a completely different environment, that you're going to have that problem solving and logical thinking and critical thinking skill that you will be able to call up and apply.
Hmm. So in your own world, I'm going to make the assumption that you've learned how to learn. So what resources, books, podcasts, movies have been challenging you and have you been learning from?
Well, the interesting thing, I come from a pre-internet world when I was really starting to figure things out. So that was, an interesting challenge. I always remember there was used to be, because I was, a long-time Mac person from the early days of Mac. And there used to be a magazine, this just tell you how ancient I am, but there was a magazine called Mac Week. Mm. It was actually a tabloid magazine, quite a hefty magazine. It came out every Monday. As soon as it would arrive in the mail, with a stamp on it in an envelope, I would stop what I was doing and I would, get a cup of coffee or something, and I would actually pore over this magazine, like every article and every ad and every inch of it, with a bit of kind of like anxiety in my chest, like, oh my God, like just all this stuff. Every week there's something new and I need to know everything that there is to know. Mm-hmm. And that was just when there was like one magazine a week. And so now it's like, you know, times infinity,
yeah,
in terms of information source. And so for me, I kind of even learned that lesson way back then, that the reality is if you are anxious about, there's so much information out there and there's so much to learn and so much to know, the reality is that 90% of that is not actually ever going to see the light of day. And the thing that will become important, the next thing, the next technology, the next technique, the next trend, when it does become important, you'll figure it out when the time comes. And that kind of, again, that just comes from, that comes from learning how to learn. And so I have to shamefully admit that I don't regularly follow any podcasts. There's definitely ones I check out from time to time if there's a specific topic, mm-hmm, that's interesting. But I don't think my heart could take it if I just was constantly consuming all of that content that's out there.
Yeah, well, that's a really good point too, and so it speaks to this, I guess, maturity of being able to, you know, admit that you don't need it all.
Mm-hmm. Well, except for this podcast, of course, we should all be listening to this on a weekly basis.
Of course. So, you know, final question, Keith, what are you excited about today?
Well, like today, I'm excited that it's still warm and sunny out. You know, I come from the great frozen north, all the way up in Vancouver, Canada. And the funny thing is that, you know, come September, the summer is already over, and I absolutely love that it extends in well into October here. It's kind of a wonderful treat for me. But from a larger perspective, what I'm really excited about is right now there's a big transition in design and communication, and it is moving fully into 3D immersive experiences with a combination of real world and created worlds coming together. You know, everything from VFX in video, 3D graphics, virtual reality, augmented reality, mixed reality, X reality. I think that is a very, very exciting prospect that we're really on the edge of. And more specifically, I have a very, very strong feeling that Portland is going to be the place for this. The Portland, and of course, I talk about Greater Portland. We've got to include our good friends in Vancouver, Washington in this. But
of course,
just like you look to Seattle and you think, you know, Amazon and Microsoft, you look to the Bay Area and you think of Google and Apple, you're going to look to the Greater Portland area and you're definitely going to be thinking about this new virtual reality, 3D graphics, augmented reality. And of course, we now need to really come up with a better name for all of this stuff. But mm-hmm, that's something that's very exciting to me, this change in the way that we're going to be communicating, and the fact that we're right now living in what will be the hub of it. Mm.
That's awesome. Well, Keith, thank you so much for taking time out of your day and sharing your journey and sharing more about business and just your passion as well. So I really thank you for your time.
My absolute pleasure.
That does it for this episode of Getting Work to Work. Thank you to Keith for taking time out of his day to share his wisdom with me about business, creativity, and technology. And thank you for taking the time to listen to Getting Work to Work. It means so much to me that you're here. Would you be willing to share Getting Work to Work with your friends, other creative professionals, and entrepreneurs? You can send them to gwtw.co or have them search for Getting Work to Work on most podcast platforms. While you're at it, head to gwtw.co, where you can sign up for the Curiosity Lab, my weekly email newsletter, and find the various social media links to Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, so you can be social with me and I can be social with you. You'll even find a link to my Patreon page where you can support my work here at Getting Work to Work, as well as future documentary projects and online courses. Would you like to be a guest on a future episode of Getting Work to Work, or know someone who should be on the show? Maybe you need some advice or just want someone to say hi to. Drop me a line by sending me an email. I'm chris@chrismartinstudios.com. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.